this, she said. You can't leave it like that. She came in and started pulling shirts over hangers and squeezing pants into metal clips. Her movements were forceful and quick. I hurried to join her. I'd failed to get a part in the fall production of Guys and Dolls and had been assigned to the role of assistant stage manager instead. My friend Tess was stage manager. We carried black binders, each scene annotated with props, stage directions, and lighting cues. Can you give me a ride home? I asked my father, assuming he could pick me up on his way home from work at Pixar, where he went on Fridays instead of next. I'd hardly noticed, living with my mother, how easy it was to get from here to there. I just arrived at place to place as if by magic. Despite our fights, there was never any question that she would drive me to and from friends' houses, doctor's appointments, dance classes, and school. Nope, he said. You're going to have to figure it out. A couple weeks later, it was opening night. In the lead-up to the play, I was probably gone for a night a week and would have loved to stay late at school more often, but did not because if I missed the car, I couldn't get a ride. On rehearsal nights, I stayed overnight with a friend. Sometimes when I was at home, my father didn't talk with me or look at me during dinner, and even Lorene seemed distant and displeased. They did not explain themselves. So I thought they might have just been upset for other reasons. But then my father began to complain that I wasn't around enough. For the opening night of the play, I planned to spend the night at Tess's house. Lorene let me borrow her black leather shoes, Joan and David Oxford's with a buckled over strap. We both wore size 6.5. The girl playing Miss Adelaide had a long neck, a nasal voice, and black hair cut like Louise Brooks's that glistened under the lights. I developed a burning crush on the star, David, who had an English accent and played Sky Masterson, and who did not seem to notice me as I rushed around with props and papers. After the play, a group of stagehands and actors and I ran outside. The lawn was dark, damp from sprinklers or dew or fog. We played Capture the Flag with two sweaters for flags. It was the first time at the new school that I was happy and unguarded. I didn't think about the shoes on the wet grass. In the morning, I noticed they were scraped in the heel with vertical grooves, as if a blade had cut stripes into the leather, and the leather had swelled, soaked in water. How could blades of grass be strong enough to cut leather? I put the shoes back into Lorene's closet when I got home, hoping she wouldn't notice. If she did notice, I figured she could certainly afford to buy another pair. She noticed the scratches a few days later, asked what had happened, upset, but then didn't mention them again. I left my things in piles around the house, the way I had when I lived with my mother. Shoes, sweatshirts, mango skins on cutting boards, papers, crumpled socks like droppings. Maybe I thought they'd find it endearing, or that I'd claim some of the attention allocated to my brother. When Lorene came into the living room one evening shortly after I'd ruined her shoes, and saw the socks and sweatshirt I left on the rug, she said, Lise, I'm going to need you to pick up all your things from now on. She said it coolly. Okay, I said. It was a reasonable thing to ask. I have enough on my plate now with a new baby and starting a company, she said. I can't be picking up after you. Her words felt like stabs. Perhaps I'd left those piles unwittingly as a kind of call and response, as if I'd asked her to claim me as her child, and she'd replied that she would not. I was humiliated and exposed. I was sloppy. She was not. My father called the school Lick My Wilmerding. I laughed and rolled my eyes. You know, I wrote you a pretty great recommendation letter to Lick My Wilmerding, he said one morning. Really? Can I see it? I thought you were going to save it and give it to her when she's older, Lorene said. I could tell she didn't want me to be arrogant or claim the center of attention. The problem with saving things for later, though, without experiencing them, is that they get lost or are forgotten. Nope. I want to do it now, he said, went to his study, returned with a sheet of paper, and, standing in the kitchen barefoot, he read the letter aloud. I don't remember the bulk of it, only the last line. If I were you, I'd snatch her up in a second. I decided to run for freshman class president and began stapling flyers to notice boards around the school. I'd made some new friends and I started an opera club, organizing group trips to the San Francisco Opera at group student rates. It was a lark. I didn't know anything about opera. Before this, I'd never been to one. On the night of the first performance, my father asked me to save him a ticket, then picked me up at school and drove us to the show. I'm so proud of you for doing this, he whispered as the curtain went up. I hoped winning president would please him too. The election was held a few weeks later, the four contenders giving short speeches. My voice was almost gone from laryngitis. I wore corduroy pants for good luck and a thick cable-knit sweater. My classmates huddled close, and I felt the surge of goodwill that sometimes happened when I was sick and no longer had the energy to be formal, instead letting others lean in to support me. That night, I missed the car ride home and stayed at a friend's house in Potrero Hill. I called my father to let him know. I dreaded these calls. Recently, when I'd stayed overnight at a friend's house in San Francisco, he'd been short and distant on the phone, sighing heavily. Lorene was working hard to start a company, and he worked a lot, too. They had Carmen until 5 p.m., but my father didn't allow employees in the house after he was home from work, and my brother wasn't sleeping through the night. I wonder if my absences stirred up conflict between them. I missed the ride home, I said when he answered, because of the election. You're not putting in the time, Lise, he said, his voice grim. You're not acting like you're part of this family. I'll be back tomorrow, I said. The elections were held. I don't care, I gotta go, he hung up. Later that night, I got another call. Guess what? It was Tess. What? After the call with my father, I'd forgotten everything else. Come on, guess. I don't know. You won, silly, she said. You're class president. This meant I'd have to attend after-school meetings for student government about once a week, spending the night at a friend's house or trying to cage a ride from the parents of my friends. This isn't working out, Lise, my father said the next day when I told him I'd won. You're not succeeding as a member of this family. You're not pulling your weight. You're never around. If you want to be part of this family, you need to put in the time. It seemed strange that he could insist on my continuous presence, having been absent for so long himself. At dinners on the nights I was home now, he and Lorene were aloof. I assumed this had to do with me. But of course, it might have had just as much to do with the difficulties of a new marriage, a toddler, and sleep deprivation. My father would make pasta, plain or with avocados, and eat carrot salad. I would slice a black bean burrito and help steam broccoli as Lorene fed my brother. As soon as dinner was over, they went upstairs to try to put him to sleep. I felt their disappointment in me like an augmentation of gravity in the room. And if I made any mistakes, it was a tick on the wrong side of a ledger, creating the sense that I would be forever outside of this thing I wanted. Family. What was the inside like? It would have an adhesive and ordinary quality. Once inside it, I could not be dislodged. I'd become indispensable. If only I could get in. He wanted me to be around, but in another room, in his orbit, not too close. I was supposed to occupy the path drawn by a compass circling around the point that was him. During this period when I was increasingly away and he was increasingly angry with me, I mentioned to my father that the schoolwork was not rigorous compared with Nueva's. Sometimes I got bored and doodled in class. Doodling? He said. That's not good. That's not good at all. In history, we're learning about the Renaissance, but I already learned about it. What followed was a strange flurry. He and I driving up to the school to meet with the head of the school, the admissions director, and several teachers, and him telling me to repeat the story about doodling, about how I was bored sometimes in class. In my imagination, I became the kind of extraordinary student for whom certain private schools are woefully inadequate. My father indulged the lie, becoming indignant on my behalf, perhaps believing me, perhaps seeing in my vanity a way out of the after-school ride conundrum. Emboldened by my father beside me, I believed my own stories. The top-rated school wasn't academically rigorous enough for me. I was too afraid to admit, even to myself, that the problem wasn't the school, but the fact that I couldn't participate in it, or see friends, or leave the house without feeling that I had betrayed some essential agreement. On the way home from another visit to the school, he suggested that we stop at Palo Alto High School, Pally for short, just to see what it was like. It was late in the afternoon, and school was out. For a few minutes, we walked around the empty quad. Many of the buildings looked like bunkers. I felt uncomfortable, as if we were trespassing. But then we heard music coming from somewhere, and we followed it over to where a tall boy was standing beside the door where the music was coming from. I was too shy to speak, but my father asked, "What's going on in here?" And the boy said, "It's the paper." And we peered into the room. There were lots of people inside, working on computers and lounging on beanbags. And I thought, if I did decide to go here, I'd work on the paper too. "You know what's great about going to a school nearby your house?" my father asked as we left. "You can walk to it, like I did. And if you walk a lot, over the course of time, you get to see the seasons change." He said it in the same slow way he spoke of beautiful women. Walking to school didn't sound very romantic to me. I decided to transfer anyway. It seemed like the only way to make it work at home. It was mid-year when I decided to transfer to Pali, and my father drove me over to sign up for classes. The administrative offices were off a long, glossy corridor that smelled of the same cleaning fluid as the public library and had the same combination of muffled sounds and sharp echoes. I felt the glow of nearness to my father, his attention on me. Walking beside him down the corridor, I felt protected. He was confident in this school. We sat down in the office of a registrar who helped to fill up my schedule, sometimes placing me in classes I needed that were already full. "Is there a student government?" I asked her. "Yes," she said. "Maybe you could run for representative. There are two per class. The elections are soon." A demotion, I thought. I'd run for president instead. Several Christmas wreaths arrived from Smith and Hawken. Three were the size of small bird's nests. My father carried one through the kitchen, to hang on the wooden beam between the banks of French doors and the hallway. He didn't want me or anyone else to touch the wreaths, or any of the Christmas decorations he'd ordered. Even the tree lights, which he insisted on hanging by himself, looping the twisted cords around the branches of a Douglas fir in a process that took him the whole day, were off limits. He fussed about the small round wreath, adjusting it on the nail, stepping back, adjusting it, stepping back again. I laughed, watching him. "I guess you have to get it just right," I said. "If it's not just right," he said in a high falsetto, rolling the R, "I will perish." When he was happy, he became goofy, able to laugh at himself and his fastidiousness. Sometimes my father sang extemporaneous rhyming songs about me to me, the way Bob Dylan did in the recording studio, he said. "My bike and hike I liked, to school my books, my looks. My life is a wife of a fife." He adjusted the wreath one last time and lunged for me, wiggling his index finger under my ribcage. I reached for him too, trying to dig my hand into his armpit to tickle him first. He got me. I laughed. A shrill laugh that did not sound like part of me. He jumped away so that I couldn't reach him, sashaying, his bare legs tapered, silly-looking, like a frog's. He'd recently bought a CD he played for me, a recording of the last castrato, who didn't sound like a woman or man, but had a haunting high kind of voice in between, like someone singing after sucking on a balloon. "Perish, simply perish," he sang again in that high voice, on the way back to his office to make a series of work calls under the spotlight of a desk lamp that looked, bent and hovering, like a praying mantis. For Christmas, he gave Lorene a ball gown from Giorgio Armani and a pair of shoes, too narrow for her feet. He gave me only the pair of shoes, the same ones he'd bought for her, slim black loafers, also from Armani. They fit me perfectly. He was cold toward Lorene after noticing the shoes didn't fit, as if her wider feet were an indication of some deeper offense. I was jealous of the ball gown, which was diaphanous, long, and unfolded out of the box. I felt superior about my feet, though, for a little while, as if their slim shape was an indication of something noble and pure. It had been more than 5 months since I'd seen my mother. I was angry with her. I missed her. I hated her. I pitied her. I wanted to eradicate all the signs of her in myself. I missed being touched by her. She didn't know what I did every day now. How I babysat my brother, and sometimes he cried, and I didn't know what to do or how to soothe him. During the months we didn't see each other, my mother had a recurring dream of a nuclear attack in which she would throw a sheet over her head and run over to get me. Finally, for Christmas, my father agreed we could see each other again. As soon as I felt I could leave, I walked to the Rinconada house and opened the front door. It had a smell, warm wood and soil and paint, that I hadn't noticed when I lived there. I hopped into her lap. I was still small enough for that. And she grabbed me, felt my shoulders and my head, my arms and legs, my fingers, and smelled my hair. Later, she described that moment for her, a shock, a relief to hold me, that some part of her, after not seeing me for so long, had felt as if I were dead. I remember that she wouldn't let me go. I started school at Pali after the holidays, using my new name. The Pali quad was grass worn away in places to stubble or bald dirt. I went to the classes in the sequence the registrar had arranged for me, using the textbooks with holes in the cover where brown cardboard showed through, notes from previous students written in the margins. I'd never had trouble making friends before. Now I was cripplingly shy, doubting myself before raising my hand in class. I didn't have a single friend. The algebra lessons at the new school were different from the ones at Lick Wilmerding, based on formulas I didn't know, more difficult. Most evenings for a couple of months, I asked Lorene to help, and she would get up with a sigh. We'd go downstairs. She'd work out the problem in a business-like way, and then tell me the procedure to follow to get the answer. At night, after they went upstairs, I was incredibly lonely and cried myself to sleep. I was also cold. I discovered the heating didn't work in my part of the house. I might have asked to move into the bedroom upstairs, the one located over the garage with slanted windows along the roof. It was the room my father had first offered to me, thinking I would like it the most because it was large, with a fireplace and its own Juliet balcony with stairs leading down to the courtyard. When he offered it, he said I might sneak out at night and winked. But that room had since been turned into a guest room, and when I finally asked to move, he said no. "I'm cold," I said to my father in the kitchen in the morning. "Would you get the heater fixed?" He pulled an apple juice from the fridge. "Nope, not until we renovate the kitchen," he said. "And we're not going to do that anytime soon." The next weekend, I parked my bike outside a clothing shop called Roxy, a white cube with English punk music blasting at noon, racks of clothing hanging so high the clothing brushed against my cheeks, short, loose jackets with shoulder pads, pleated pants, t-shirts and bright pastels. I'd been there with my mother, among the pleated, silky pants and patterned skirts and music. and I'd come back to feel the familiar surroundings. When I walked out of the shop, the bike was gone. I figured my father would get me another one, now that he didn't have to pay for the car service or the private school. Also, although I couldn't articulate this, I had a feeling he owed me. I thought he and Loreen would come to understand that and try to make it up to me, that he would pity me eventually and it would hit him. The feeling of being owed was like a cloud darkening the air around me that would lift and disperse when my father was kind to me, but then settle again thickly. I couldn't get it to go away for good. Anyway, I needed a bike now that I was supposed to get myself around. "Lise," he said when I told him about the bike, "you're not doing a great job keeping track of stuff." It was morning at the table with my father, Loreen, Reed, and me. "I'm trying." I hoped Loreen would come to my rescue. "You're letting things slide," he said. "It was a mistake." "Well, I have an idea. I'll get you a new bike if you do the dishes. Every night. And babysit whenever we need you."
"Okay," I said quickly. It was a bad deal, and I knew it. I should have negotiated. I was certain he knew it was a bad deal, too. But I thought that if they observed me take it anyway, they'd be more generous with me. It would compensate for the way I was absent before. It would give me a chance to prove my dedication.
The dishwasher that came at the house was built into the kitchen island and didn't work. And my father said he wouldn't replace it, so I did the dishes by hand with a sherbet-colored sponge. I stood on the cold terracotta tiles, seeing my reflection in the window turned into a mirror at night, and lined up the plates to dry in the slats of a wooden rack. The request that had seemed oppressive and Sisyphean at my mother's house, to make the bed, set the table, clean the counters, write thank you notes, I did now mostly without anyone bugging me. When I finished the dishes, I looked through the family photographs in a shoebox kept in a kitchen drawer, noticing how many pictures there were of my brother, how few of me. I flipped through the stack, removing the pictures of myself I didn't like. Maybe they'd noticed there were too few and realized their mistake in not taking more. After they put my brother to sleep, my father would come down to his office to work for a few hours. Sitting at my desk, I could hear when he left his office again to go up to bed. I listened to his feet on the tile as he turned left at the staircase and went upstairs. It would have been easy for him to walk a few more steps, duck his head into my room, and say goodnight. But I was 14, too old to need a goodnight. My mother had always done so, a part of our pattern that was, I thought, infantilizing, and that I could have done without. Here, I burned for it. What did I want? What did I expect? He didn't need me the way I needed him. A dark and frightening loneliness came over me, a sharp pain beneath my ribs. I cried myself to sleep, the tears turning cold and pooling in my ears. Yet even in the middle of my most profound, heavy-legged self-pity, I was aware of the fact that my bedroom wasn't that cold. It was California, and if the house cleaner didn't wash my dirty laundry, she did wash my sheets every couple of weeks, and some pictures did contain me. After school, Carmen sometimes braided my hair in the kitchen while my brother napped. She was loving toward me. She knew how to make a variety of braids, including a braid in a circle around my head like a crown. Her braids didn't fray or slip, but remained for a couple of days, despite the fact that my hair was fine and slick. I wore them until they became loose, muzzy with escaped hairs that formed a halo in the light. I sat in the kitchen chair as she shivered my scalp with her fingernails pulling strands. I closed my eyes. I liked being touched. In those moments, I thought she and I were lucky to be in this house, with its brick and sparkling windows, the jasmine vine that bloomed around the front door and gave off a quenching smell like you could drink it. As my brother slept one weekend afternoon, my father, Loreen, and I went to sit outside at the table in the courtyard.
Lorene cut watermelon and brought it out on a plate. Before she ate each piece, she rubbed it around her lips like a gloss, wetting them with the juice. My father was sitting beside her, watched her wet her lips, then grabbed her shoulder and pulled her toward him, leaning across the chair. I wanted to leave, but my feet were heavy on the brick, as if some invisible external pressure compelled me to stay. The two of them formed a tableau. Him pulling her in to kiss, moving his hand closer to her breasts, and the part of her leg where her skirt ended, moaning theatrically, as if for an audience. He'd done the same with Tina. Why didn't these women push him away, I wondered. I felt my aloneness in the courtyard acutely, how there was no one else there to say, stop. The emotions didn't feel real, but like a performance. Like Cary Grant in North by Northwest, kissing Eva Marie Saint on the train. I could see a scythe of her white cotton underwear between her legs under the hem of her jean skirt. My mother had taught me to close my knees when I wore a skirt. I wondered, did her mother not teach her that? I was angry that she was doing something like a child, an adult, at the same time. Letting him kiss her like this in front of me, and that she didn't know or care to close her knees. I started to rise finally and moved toward the door of the house. They detached. Hey, Lise, he said. Stay here. We're having a family moment. It's important that you try to be part of this family. I sat still, looking away as he moaned and undulated in the side of my vision. It was not clear how long it would go on. I looked into the grass of the courtyard, at the blooming crabapple tree that grew beside the curving brick path, a profusion of tiny white and pink blossoms hovering above the trunk. Although I couldn't have known it clearly then, I hoped Lorene would fix our family, pry my father open, demand his full heart and attention, and get him to acknowledge what he'd missed. If I was angry now that she was also human and flawed, she didn't close her knees, didn't push him away in front of me. It was because of the immensity of the job I had in mind for her. She was the last resort after everyone else had failed. But in this girlish lapse, I saw hints that she might not choose or even be able to inhabit the role I'd assigned her. That she was not here to fix my father for me. My mother and I planned to meet for brunch on a Saturday. Since our reunion at Christmas, we'd seen each other twice, but these visits had devolved into fights. I picked Ile Forneo because it was close enough that I could get there and back on my own, a 20-minute walk to my father's house. I didn't have a new bike yet. If she lost her temper, I could leave. When I arrived, she was already waiting. We hugged. She was wearing a new dress. The maitre d' with the gray mustache said, "Follow me," and walked us into the courtyard past the fountain to a round metal table near a potted tree covered in purple flowers. He didn't seem to recognize me, even though I'd come here many times with my father to pick up marinara pizzas with onions, olives, and oregano. My mother faced out, and I faced the back of the courtyard, where there were no more tables. We put our napkins in our laps. We weren't connected anymore, but separate. I wasn't sure how to let her know that I was still her daughter. If she yelled, I would get up and leave. Just imagining it, the boldness of it, made me feel giddy and guilty both. "How are you doing?" she asked. "I'm okay," I said. "How are you?" "I'm fine." "I miss you." "How do you like Pally?"
"It's all right."
It was terrible.
"I mean, I think it will get better," I said in a cheery voice.
The formality could not continue. I knew she would break it.
"So it sounds like everything's just great," she said, a hint of sarcasm.
The waiter came and asked if we were ready to order. Jolly, as if he were interacting with any mother and daughter on any morning. I ordered the pancakes with stewed peaches and whipped cream.
"You just seem like this strange, distant person," she said when the waiter left. Completely different. It's like you're not even my daughter anymore since you moved out. She sounded curious about it, and the curiosity hurt me, as if she noticed but didn't care. I wondered if it was true. I might be worse than I thought. Irreparably changed. Near her, I was a perfect shell that even I could not break. I moved out because we were fighting, I said. I didn't want to. Oh, come on, she said. You just worry about yourself. Your perfect life. Things get tough and Lisa goes with the rich people. Poof. My life didn't feel rich. Maybe it looked rich or richer from the outside. It was true, I had nicer clothes now. Not a lot of clothes, but better ones and newer. When we went for Indian food at the mall, my father would sometimes guide us into Armani Exchange, where he would buy me a t-shirt or a pair of trousers. Before this, when I got something new, I'd wear it a lot and wear it out until it looked like the other things in my closet. But shopping with them worked differently. Small and more frequent renewals, nicer fabrics, and because most of the clothes came from the same shop at around the same time, they went together. Blue, white, charcoal. For the first time, when I looked into my closet, I could find something newish that fit and could be worn with something else newish that fit. I knew my mother would have loved to have the same feeling, and I felt guilty to have it first. You have a real problem, Lisa, she continued, growling through her clenched teeth. You know what's wrong with you? You want to be like them so much that you have no idea what's important in life. In fact, I wanted to be just like them, but it wasn't possible, hard as I tried. I stuck out. I did not blend, needing more than I was given and hoping to hide it. My mother began to speak in a high, piercing voice meant to mock mine. I'm just so delicate, such a princess, she said. You're like them, she said. She began to raise her voice and speak angrily. Cold and heartless and phony. I guess you might as well be with them. I looked around at the other tables. No one was sitting too close, but a few people looked. This isn't okay, I said, standing. You can't yell at me anymore. I'm leaving. She looked at me, stunned. I walked through the courtyard, through the belly of the restaurant, past the row of chefs, the bustle, the warmth, and din. I was self-conscious about my back and my legs. Everything she could see as she watched me go. The way I moved, my clothes, the way I walked, might confirm what she'd said about me. I tried to walk as I'd always walked, the way I'd walked when I was with her, so that she would see this walk and understand that I was still who I was before. I quickened my step as soon as I was out the door, in case she was following me to yell more. I wanted her to follow me. I was terrified she would. I walked home. My hands were shaking. I'd abandoned my mother. I'd left her all alone. The street was empty and peaceful. I felt a strange sort of calm, too calm. I was a girl walking and a girl who watched a girl walking. I was what she said I was, a kind of person who left the people they loved. I kept looking back. In between looks, I stepped carefully to avoid the hard fruits from the sweet gums. The trees were fiery orange and red, with star-shaped leaves. And because it had rained the day before, there were leaves on the ground, unnaturally bright on the gray sidewalk. The fruits were the size of cherries, brown, with brown spines. They left rust-colored marks on the sidewalk. These same fruits had fallen from the tree in the backyard at the Rinconada house, thonking on the deck, so many that it had been impossible to walk without losing my balance, until my mother came outside and swept them away. When election season arrived a month or two into the semester, I handed out flyers announcing my candidacy for class president. Passing them around, I realized the problem was that I didn't know the other students, who all knew one another, and they didn't know me. I wore a black skirt that fell to my mid-calf. They walked by in jeans, in groups of two or three, and gave half smiles. Some took my flyers, Some smirked and said, no thanks.
Sorry, who are you?
A girl said.
A new freshman, I said. I just transferred in.
And you're running for president?
Yeah, I said, realizing at that moment how absurd it must have looked. She took a flyer and walked away.
At Lick Wilmerding, students had come from a variety of schools. Here, most had known each other since kindergarten. The gossip circulated that I was Steve Jobs' kid, which likely made my run for president even less attractive. But at the time, I wasn't aware of it. I was only embarrassed and a little ashamed, driving for the position of president with stubbornness, as if, with enough willpower, I would recreate the triumph from my old school. When the votes were counted, a boy named Kyle had won. He wore plaid shirts and khakis and had a strong, definitive voice, a large Adam's apple, a long neck. That night, my father and Lorene went to a dinner party, and I looked after my brother. They had me babysit a lot, telling me at the last minute as their plans resolved. I loved my brother and didn't mind watching him, but I felt unseen as they put him into my arms without asking and left. My father had already left me when I was little. Now he made me care for the next one as he walked out the door. I fed my brother as he squirmed delightfully, read him books he tried to rip, and tried to sing him to sleep. He would not sleep. He cried, unconsoled by the milk I'd heated and tested on the inside of my wrist. He wailed for what seemed like hours, his face crimson, his cheeks wet, his mouth wide open. I called the number they'd left. No one picked up. I paced back and forth with him in my arms in front of the windows that became mirrors at night, wondering if this is what it had been like for my mother, alone with me. A week or so after our brunch at Il Forneo, my mother and I talked on the phone. She said she was sorry, that she shouldn't have yelled, that she wasn't mad at me and understood why I'd moved out. She'd been offered a lucrative job painting stenciled images and signage for a large women's and children's hospital in Los Angeles, which meant she'd be gone most of the time for a month or so, and we wouldn't see each other, but we'd continue to talk at night. When she returned, she would start making canvas stick-on animals for the walls of children's rooms. A hospital nearby hired her to do stenciled murals covering the walls of several rooms. And for another hospital, she was hired to paint trees with stenciled donor names on the fruit. She hired an assistant to help with the larger projects, and they worked together in her converted garage, playing the Cranberries, Talking Heads, Paul Simon, Ladysmith, Black Mambazo. My parents would see each other around town occasionally, at Country Sun or Whole Foods. I heard about these encounters from my mother, who didn't relish running into them, but reported that they'd been kind to each other, saying hello or mentioning something about me, or him asking her to say hello to Tina. Tina and my mother were still friends, and they sometimes had breakfast at Joni's Cafe on California Avenue. When I asked how Tina was doing, my mother said that my father had been calling her 10 or 20 times a day, leaving messages on her answering machine about wanting to get back together. One morning, my father read the newspaper and then sang "This Old Man" to my brother, identifying the paddywhacked part and rolling my brother's hands for the dog and the bone, my brother squirming to get free. Lorene left the kitchen to change clothes for an aerobics class. My father stopped playing with Reed for a moment and looked at me.
Hey, he said, how do you think Tina's doing?
He had begun to ask about Tina when the two of us were alone, or alone with Reed, asking each time like it was the first time, as if the question had just occurred to him. It soon became the only topic then that he spoke with me about directly, making me feel important, so that even though it made me feel furtive, I also liked it. I think she's doing okay, I said. I didn't let on that I knew about the phone calls, or that I understood that his question was less about Tina and more about himself. I knew too much. I didn't want to give him so much information that he stopped asking. I felt a strange and wonderful power. Knowing about Tina, I was useful to him, even if I was disloyal and sneaky.
I really miss her, he said.
When Lorene returned, we played with Reed in the kitchen and made lunch. My father left the room and returned with his camera, the big-lensed, expensive camera no one else was allowed to touch. I wanted to be in the pictures he took. I wanted it with an unseemly desperation. I also wished to be my brother instead of myself. It didn't matter if I had to give up my life until now, because that was nothing. The way I imagined it, this would not be death. Just lucky me. I get to be him, this time born right. I could imagine the exhilaration. The wish was more powerful than any wish I'd felt before, and had an unfamiliar, urgent force. And because of this difference from ordinary life, I believed in some small way that it could happen. I searched my palms for a hint of when or how.
Lisa, step aside, he said in a business voice, holding his camera in front of his eye, the lens like a marble or a deep, still pool.
I jumped toward the sink, out of the frame. From behind him, I continued to coax my brother to smile so my father wouldn't know it hurt.
Lise can come in, Steve, Lorene said. She held her hand out to me. Come on, Lise.
I went to stand beside her. I was so grateful to her, it made me shake. Early one morning, Lorene took me with her on a trip with the Audubon Society. We rode in a van full of people to a nature preserve with thin, tall trees on either side of a sand path, birds moving the branches. A few days later, my father came into my room. He was distraught, pacing.
What is it? I asked. What's wrong?
What matters in life, he said, is only what you do with your own hands.
I don't understand, I said.
The bird trip, he said. That sort of thing.
What did he mean?
The trip had seemed innocent. The quiet footsteps, heads up, carrying binoculars, looking for the origin of the trills.
These sorts of things don't mean anything. They aren't real.
I know, I said, emphatically, though I didn't.
Later, I understood the trip had been given to us with the hope that he or Lorene would contribute money to the Audubon Society, and this bothered him profoundly. I didn't want to be his conscience, the one he confided in when something went wrong, the one with whom he shared a stricter value system. I was some grainy old photograph from before he'd lost himself, as my mother had said. The photograph got dusty, and he'd return sometimes to look at it, to wipe away the dust and look, but then he'd leave again and forget.
People who aren't born here, he meant California, they just don't get it.
Sometimes when I left the house, Lorene would slip me a $20 bill where he couldn't see it. She told me I looked pretty. I asked once if he gave to charity, and he snapped at me, saying it was none of my business. Lorene had bought a velvet dress for her niece on his credit card, and he gave her a hard time, reading the bill aloud in the kitchen. I assumed his frugality was part of the reason we didn't have much furniture, and that the reason he wouldn't hire more help to take care of my brother or clean the house was that he was tight. Although this may not have been true. He made calculations out loud about what things cost, at the grocery store, and at restaurants, and the Gap, and what a normal family could afford, and was indignant when things were too expensive and refused to buy them, when I wished he'd just accept that he wasn't normal and splurge. I'd also heard of his generosity, how he'd bought an Alfa Romeo for Tina, and a BMW for Lorene, and paid off her school loans. I thought he was mostly frugal with me, refusing to get me more jeans or furniture or heat, and generous with everyone else. It was hard to understand why someone who had enough money would create a sense of scarcity, why he wouldn't lavish us with it. Besides the Porsche, my father kept a large silver Mercedes. I called it Small Nation, a nickname I made up.
Why Small Nation? He asked.
Because it's big enough to cover a small nation? Heavy enough to crush it, and expensive enough to feed the population for a year, I said. It was a joke. But I also wanted to hurt him for what I thought was his extravagant spending on himself, throw him into self-reflection, bring about some revelation.
Small nation, he said, chuckling. That's really funny, Lise.
One day at home, passing me in the hallway, my father said to me, "You know, each of my girlfriends has had a more difficult relationship with her father than the last." I didn't know what to make of the statement, or why he'd said it. Like me, most of the women I knew did not have fathers when they were growing up. Fathers died, divorced, or left. Not having a father wasn't unique, or even significant. My father's significance was elsewhere. Instead of raising me, he was inventing world-changing machines. He was famous, mingling, accruing, driving stoned in the south of France with a billionaire named Bigozzi, dating Joan Baez. I figured no one would think, hey, that guy should have been raising his daughter instead. What presumption. To whatever degree I felt grieved by having lost him for so long, and to whatever extent this grief arose powerfully in me, I suppressed it, or was not fully aware of it. It was wrong, selfish. I was nothing. I dismissed the fact of my own importance to him, his importance to me, or even the importance of fathers and children more generally. A dismissal so familiar to me then that I didn't even notice it. It was part of the air. It was only recently when an older friend, a father himself, called to tell me about his daughter's engagement that I understood something new. His daughter and her fiancé came to tell him the news, and he'd cried, surprising himself. "What was it that made you cry?" I asked. "It was this. Since the day she was born, it had been my job, our job, to protect her and care for her," he said. "I realized that from now on it would be someone else's job. I was no longer on the front line, no longer the main person." When we got off the phone, I started to suspect I'd underestimated what I'd missed, what my father had missed. When I lived with him, I tried to put it into the language of dishwashers and couches and bikes, as if to reduce his absence to things. I felt owed trifles so resolutely, so achingly. In fact, it was something bigger. Something I'd felt for a gut visceral moment on the phone as a whole intricate universe. The kind of care and love we'd missed that can occur between a father and child. When I was reading, I was not lonely or self-aware. I felt upheld by the stories. I read a whole stack of fiction at one time, alternating between books so I could finish all of them together. The multiple endings crashing around me like the cymbals in a musical finale. When I stopped reading, I felt lonely again, like a window had been thrown open. The same carpenter who built my brother's changing table also built the bookshelves on one wall of my father's office, carefully matching the backside of each shelf to the dimpled indentations of the white painted brick. Some nights after he'd gone to sleep, I went into his office and perused the books, including one about Noguchi and The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, an autobiography of a yogi. On his desk beside the next computer was a box that contained 12 new black Uniball pens. He used these pens always and usually had one in his pocket. I took three. In his office, with everyone else in the house asleep, I sat on his rug and read with a pen in my hand. Here was a feeling of abundance and freedom. Any book I wanted, pens, no one bothering me or following me around. Around that time, I read a copy of Salinger's Franny and Zoe. It was a matte white paperback with black text and two stripes of color across the front. I read it repeatedly until my copy frayed, the cover collecting dirt from my hands and my backpack. Trains, frigid train stations, coats, dorms, diners, drinks. Here was the East Coast, the Ivy League, Harvard. A different planet, a different class. Did it exist like this? Really? I doubted it. The characters used words foreign to me, clipped and slick. Nonetheless, I wanted to be Franny. She was real enough. She gushed with absolutely and lovely and love. Trains were numbers, the 1052. They arrived on cold platforms where you could see your breath. Against the cold, people wore overcoats, topcoats, raccoon fur coats, buttoned wool linings. I decided I would go to Harvard, because that was the college they talked about in the book. I would leave, get away from this town, the world of my parents. I wouldn't let them know how fixed my plan was, because they might try to stop me. It was different from anything my parents had done, but might impress them nonetheless. This seemed like the answer, a plan to get out that was above reproach. I didn't know what I wanted to study or how I wanted college to be, really, but figured if I went to Harvard, those things would become clear. I started collecting coats, not realizing why, asking for coats as gifts for birthdays and Christmas, even though it was often too warm in Northern California for the kind of coats I received. As the school years progressed, I understood I was collecting for college, and I collected with decisive fervor, even if it would turn out that these coats, although too warm for California, wouldn't be warm enough for the East Coast. I didn't tell my father about how determined I was because it was too delicate a plan to withstand him, too unfinished. I sensed he wouldn't like it when I left and didn't understand how soon it would happen, even as he joked about my future marriage to Biff and Tad and the rest. I'd have to get out by stealth, that even if he did not believe in raising the kind of child who would hang around and never leave, feeding off his charisma, he might try to create that kind of child anyway, despite himself. For a joke, my father would turn his back, moan, and move his hands up and down until they seemed disembodied, like someone else's hands. When he spoke to me directly about love and sex, he was curious and interested. The two of us equals, a team. I did not feel the same revulsion I did when talking about sex with my mother. Maybe it was because I hadn't grown up with him. "Let's go over the bases again," he said, in a kind but officious tone. We used the language of baseball, a game neither of us knew or cared about. "You mean for making out?" I asked. "Yeah. So first base is kissing," he prompted. I knew it was ridiculous, but I liked it. He asked me about once a week, as if he'd forgotten in between. This was a repetitive exercise. I didn't have a boyfriend and wasn't making any progress, but I went through what I knew. He continued to prompt. The only confusion I had was third base, called feeling down, which may or may not have included oral sex, so I didn't mention that part and hoped he wouldn't want more details. "And which base are you at?" he asked. "Second," I said. "From Nueva?" "Ah," he said. "Great." One evening when Lorene got home, I went outside to meet her, near the roses beside the gate. "You know that computer, Thalisa?" she said, closing the gate, the ring clanking, her hair flashing in the sunlight, a large leather satchel on her shoulder. "It was named after you, right?" We'd never talked about it before, and I wasn't sure why she was asking now. Maybe someone had asked her. "I don't know. I think so," I lied. I hoped she'd drop it. "It must have been," she said. "Let's ask him when he gets back." "It really doesn't matter," I said. I didn't want him to say no again. Though maybe if she asked him, he would say yes. A few minutes later, he came in the gate and Lorene walked up to him. I followed. "Hun," she said, "that computer was named after Lisa, right?" "Nope," he said. "Seriously?" "Yep, seriously," he said. "Come on." She looked him in the eye. I was impressed and grateful she kept pushing while I would have given up. They faced each other, stopped on the path on the way to the door. "It wasn't," he said. Then I wished she hadn't asked. I was embarrassed for her to discover that I wasn't as important to him as she might have thought. "Well then, who is it named after?"
An old girlfriend, he said,
looking off into the distance as if remembering. Wistful. It was this dreamy quality that made me believe he was telling the truth, because otherwise it was quite an act. I had a strange feeling in my stomach, the same one I got when something was fake or phony, but I was getting that feeling a lot lately. And why would he lie anyway? His true well of feeling was clearly reserved for the other Lisa. I never heard of a girlfriend named Lisa from when he was young, and when I mentioned it to my mother later, she said, hogwash. But maybe she didn't know. Maybe he'd kept the first Lisa from us both.
Sorry, kid, he said, patting me on the back, then walking into the house.
My father opened a large, thick paper envelope, an invitation to a wedding in Napa.
Hey, Lise, you want to come?
Often when my father and Lorraine went to parties, I babysat for my brother. This time, I would be included, in public, part of the family, the daughter, the sister. I thought of what dress to bring and how I'd have to buy nylons, an ecstasy of decision-making. A few weeks later, the date of the wedding arrived. On the way, we stopped for sandwiches at a fancy grocery store, and later on the road, my father shook a water bottle when I said I had to pee. My brother sat beside me in his elevated seat. Shortly before we arrived, my father delivered a lecture about risk and consequence that seemed like a performance.
Lise, do you know about risk and consequence? He asked. It's a way of evaluating whether to do something, a sliding scale. For example, if the risk is low but the consequence is high, you might decide not to do something.
Right, I said.
Even laws, he said. They aren't about what you can and can't do. They're based on whether or not you get caught. For example, cars can do 120 miles an hour, way faster than any speed limit in this country. You can drive as fast as you want, as long as you don't get caught.
I remembered a story my mother told me about how, before I knew him, he'd drive home so fast down the roads in Woodside and without license plates that for almost a year the cops couldn't catch him. He was the cool one, the fast one, telling me how to break rules. I could see the freedom of his intelligence, how it made you lighter on your feet. The ceremony would be held at the Meadowood Napa Valley, with its grand curving entrance, somewhere near the golf course, past pools and suites that looked like wood cabins. When we arrived at the hotel and got into the room, we all got ready. Lorraine put my brother in a light blue cotton confection, pantaloons with straps over the shoulders. She wore a dress made of vintage Japanese kimonos stitched together. My father wore a black formal jacket, a white shirt, and jeans.
Okay, we're off, he said, almost to the door.
The idea that I was invited to the ceremony had been implied, but never explicitly stated.
Hold on, I'm not ready yet,
I said. I just hitched up my stockings. Damp skin made them stick midway.
That's all right, Lorraine said. Take your time. Here he is.
She handed Reed to me in a way that suggested she was in motion and I would be still. By her tone and movement, I understood. They were moving quickly as if to flee. No time to mention what we should eat for dinner. When I realized my mistake, I felt ashamed most of all to have presumed. But in the car when I'd hung the dress, they might have told me I wouldn't need any dresses.
Why don't you two head out? Maybe to the pool, Lorraine said as they walked through the door.
I changed into jeans. Outside the door of each room was parked a red wagon. I put Reed inside, leaving his fancy outfit on. He wanted to be pulled, and then carried, and then pulled again. The weather was damp and cool. Too cool for swimming.
Kai,
Reed said, pointing up. Bug, tree, pool. The light was muted under a thin layer of clouds like tissue paper that made it diffuse. Everywhere and nowhere. When we reached the place where the pavement ended and the field began, I lifted him out of the wagon and he ran forward toward the edge of the pool. almost tripping on clods of dirt in the grass, but managing to stay upright, always on the cusp of falling, like a marionette held under the armpits by strings. I ran after him and caught him, helped him lie belly down on the concrete lip so he could touch the water.